You know what? I'm taking this thing down here. Elise has great fears for me. Let's see, that's about central. Elise has great fears for me because last night when Steve finished, I got up on the platform to pray with people, and I was sitting over there and I got up on the platform here. Literally gazelle-like. Just smooth as you like. And this morning, my ministry colleague says, please use the steps today. I don't want you to tear a hamstring. How about that? I said, if you get up on a platform, if you're going to tear anything, it's going to be a quadriceps. So we had a little technical conversation there. And then David walks in today and he's got a trolley. I said, what's David up to? I copped another one. She said, I think he's come to finally take you off to the asylum. Now, Brother Ian, we're having a meeting after service today, elders meeting. We need to rein that in. Well, it's all right to have a bit of fun, isn't it? There was a fellow in America, in the state of Oregon, in America, who'd been a deacon in a local Baptist church, been a faithful man of God, and served God faithfully for years and years. And he ended up with cancer, and he was dying. And he's in the last few days of his life. And his pastor come to visit him, as any good pastor would do. He sat by his bed and he said, how do you feel? You know, you're like days from death. He said, well, I've been laying here today and I've been thinking, in just a few days' time, I'm going to say goodbye forever to two old friends. But I'm going to be holding hands forever with one old friend. Pastor said, that sounds like a riddle. He said, who are the two? You won't be thinking he was talking about two people. Who are the two that you'll be saying goodbye to? And he said, I'll be saying goodbye to faith and hope. I won't be needing those anymore. But he said, I will be holding hands and standing with a God of love for eternity. And he said, I can't wait. 2 days later, he closed his eyes in death. Do you know why that man could say a thing like that? Because he'd come to understand what Peter was talking about in this passage, as we close off today, as we finish off today, this passage we've been in. Peter says, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and then add to your knowledge, it's starting to run out, self-control, and to self-control patient endurance, and to patient endurance godliness, and to godliness, brotherly kindness. And then he says, and to brotherly kindness, agape. I've known, because I planned this series over a long time ago, and I knew this day was coming. And in many ways, I dreaded it. I've been dreading it. Agape is a confronting, challenging word. Because do you know what brotherly kindness, we talked about brotherly kindness last week, and we talked about Paul and Philemon and Onesimus, and That seems like it's achievable. Seems like it's readily achievable. But agape, what does that look like? Let's go back in our Bibles to John chapter 17, to the real Lord's Prayer. And 72 hours before he was crucified, Jesus prayed this prayer. It only takes a few minutes to read the whole thing, but I'm only going to read to you at the very end of it. This is how he ends his prayer. All the apostles, all the disciples are listening. In their presence, he prays this prayer and he says, O righteous Father, the world has not known you, but I have known you, and these have known, these, right here, these apostles here, these have known that that you have sent me, and I have declared unto them your name, and I will declare it, that the love, agape is the word used there, that the love wherewith you have loved me may be in them. It's the words of the Master. He said, you have loved me, Father, with a love so pure, a love so all-consuming that it gives and it gives and it gives and it has no expectation of anything coming back in return. That's what agape means. That's a definition of the Greek word agape. It's the highest possible form, the purest possible form of love, and it emanates solely from God. You can't generate that. You know, when you meet up with somebody and you fall in love. You ever thought about that? Falling in love. What does that mean? Falling in love. You don't fall in love. You just begin to be kindly affectioned. Someone. Yeah. Christine's got a good answer. You rise up into love. That's good. I like that. You don't fall in love. I've always wondered when I was practicing. You know, the girls would come into you and tell me that they fell pregnant. You fell pregnant. I don't know where this stuff comes from. But you don't fall in love. Love is something that grows. And, you know, when I first met Robin, you know, I was doing my best to sort of play the field a bit and get around. But she was after me and she, you know, she... Yeah, these Cranbourne girls, I tell you what, they were a handful. At any rate, I got caught. And, you know, you would find creative ways when you were dating to say, I love you. You would find creative ways to say that. And it was always a big risk because when you say, you think to yourself, I'm going to tell this girl that I'm in love with her. What if she says, oh, yeah? I mean, it's a pretty big risk. And she made the mistake of telling me that she was in love with me, which is, I couldn't quite understand, but at any rate, there you are. There it was. And, you know, as time has gone on, and we've gotten married and we've had children and done all those things, and, you know, that's all gone now, an empty nest. But now it's a different, deeper, purer form of love as you grow together. It's actually a bit spooky because if we go out for dinner and we grab a menu, you start looking through it. I already know what she's going to order, and she knows what I'm going to order, and that's crazy. And what's even worse, as we leave church and get in our car, we're going to go and have lunch, and I'm thinking to myself, where could I take my wife for lunch today that she'd really enjoy? And I think, and I settle on a place, and she turns around seconds later and says, "How about we go to Oscar's for lunch?" See, that's love that's grown, you know, like that. That's a beautiful, pure form of love. Peter, and we'll come back to him in a moment, but Peter says, add this form of love to your brotherly kindness. Your brotherly kindness is a special kind of a love that's got it's a love on steroids. It's a love that has you do things. You see a need in someone's life and you meet that need. You know, Sue and Len last night, Steve had a need in his life. He needed electricity. So bang, no question. He's over at their place and he's plugged in. That's brotherly kindness. That's what that is. And it's great to see that, you know, in the church amongst people. But you know, throughout the course of the week, and I'll be quite frank and blunt in telling you this, I studied this word and I said, "Father, what does this even look like? The love of God. Who's qualified to speak on the love of God? Not me." And all through the week, I'm asking God and I'm telling God, I want this in my life. I desperately want this to be characteristic of who I am. I want you guys, as members of Haddon Church of Christ, I want you to feel that love from your pastor. I don't want you to be in any doubt about why I do what I do and the way I go about it. I want you, I desperately want you to feel that, and yet you feel like you're reaching for the bottom of the swimming pool and it's not there. Because it's such a pure, such a divine form of love, you feel completely unworthy of even thinking that you could be a vehicle of that. So I ask God, what does this look like? I want to tell people, I want to tell your people on Sunday what agape looks like. And he said, "Well, that's no problem. I had Paul tell you in detail what it looks like. And we're going to go and look at it today, and I'll tell you what it is like." Have you ever seen those balls? They have got all these different faces on this ball, and the thing spins and light goes flying off in every direction, and all these stupid people go in those places and take drugs and act like idiots. These great big balls, they're multifaceted balls. It's the same thing with agape love. It's multifaceted. It's not a single thing. You can't understand it by thinking of it as a single entity. It has all sorts of aspects to it and surfaces to it. And Paul explained that to us in 1 Corinthians 13, if you'd like to turn there with me. And we're just going to quickly work our way through these things and pick them apart. And here he uses the word in the Old Testament, Old King James Version word is charity, which is translated today love, which is correct. And he says, charity or love suffers long. It patiently endures. When you patiently endure, you are expressing agape love. When you're prepared to wait and to wait and to wait patiently for an outcome from God, that's an aspect of God's agape love. Patiently enduring. It suffers long. And it says it's kind. You ever said an unkind word to somebody? Everybody in the room has done that. You have made a statement to somebody, the intention of which is to hurt. It's the exact opposite of agape love. Agape is kind, and it seeks to be kind. Not not just today and not tomorrow, but always it seeks to be kind. Next time you pick up the phone to call somebody else and talk about somebody else, think twice and ask yourself the question, is this kind? Is it necessary? Am I going to be edified by it? Is the person I'm speaking to going to be edified by it? This is God's standard. Love is kind, long-suffering, patiently enduring, and it's kind. He says that love doesn't puff itself up. It doesn't brag. It doesn't brag, and it's not puffed up, and doesn't behave itself unseemly, and it doesn't seek to attract attention to itself. You know, last night, one of the things that really did affect me quite deeply is in speaking with Steve prior to the night, and watching what he was doing, and thinking about where he has been. And he told a story during this thing that just exemplified all these characteristics that I've just read out exemplified that. He goes into the Australian outback in the dust and the flies and the heat, and he takes a whole bunch of musical instruments and he sits around in Aboriginal communities. He sits around and he just worships with them. And he leads these people in worship. And you know why? Because God has endued the man with a love for the Aboriginal people. And he goes there and he worships with them and he leads them to Christ. And there's Christians amongst the Aboriginal tribes of Central Australia all over the place now, because everywhere where that man goes, there's a legacy of the love of Christ that has been left. That's a wonderful story. So love it patiently endures. It's kind. It doesn't envy. It doesn't brag. It's not puffed up. And you know, built within that structure there is one of the most devastating sins of the human flesh is built within this. And in some translations, vaunteth not itself actually comes up as it is not jealous. Jealousy is a deep-rooted cause of bitterness in the human life. It's a horrible thing, because jealousy is a thing that envies somebody else and demands for yourself something that didn't come that you thought should have come. Jealous of a man, there have been murders committed because of jealousy. A man jealous of his wife, or vice versa. And you know, there was a fella, I had a patient many years ago in Adelaide, and she went on a trip to Morocco and she met a bloke in Morocco, and she came back and she said, I'm sponsoring him to come into Australia and he's going to marry me. We're in love. I held my breath and I was, well, you know, I mean, within the context of a consultation, it's hardly marriage guidance counselling, so I just held my breath. Within 2 weeks of him arriving, he had gone through her house, taken every photograph of her family and smashed them, had taken all of her clothing and her, you know, jeans and things, and burnt them, and told her that she could only leave the house with him. She could only leave the house dressed top to toe with Muslim scarf on. And her life became a misery because she rebelled against that. She said, this is not loving me. And so he taught her a lesson. And she flew the coop. And she turned up in my clinic badly injured. What was it that drove that? Jealousy. Jealousy, friends, is a curse. If you have an issue with jealousy, you take it to the cross for crucifixion. Because you know what, if you don't, doesn't matter where, doesn't matter how you try to deal with it, doesn't matter where you go in life, it'll follow you until you actually put it to death. And what needs to be put to death at the cross. It creates so much grief and so much disaster. And it's the exact opposite. In point of fact, this love of God is the exact opposite to jealousy. Instead of wanting for me, I want for you. And I'm pleased for you. And I'm happy for you. And I'm genuine and sincere in being happy for you in this. Jealousy is something that just burns and eats you up. It says, it doesn't behave itself in an unseemly way. It doesn't seek itself, and it's not easily provoked, and it thinks no evil. It doesn't reason with evil. It reasons in purity. It reasons about what is best for this person, not what is best for me. And this typifies Christ. Was it best for Christ to go to the cross? Did he not say, Father, if this cup could just pass from me and there could be some other way? That's where Jesus was at. But then what was the response? But not my will, but yours be done. That's agape. Do you know what he did that day? That day, he looked into eternity future and he saw my wife Robin in a little church in America, lost. And he said, if I don't do this, she'll remain lost. And he would have done it for one single person. For one person, he would have done it. But he did it for Robin. And he did it for me. And he did it for Grandma. And he did it for Terry. And he did it for Nola. I know he did it for Nola because I was there the day it happened. He did it for Elise. He did it for your whole family. He said, I'm going to love so selflessly, such with such purity, that I'm going to give my life and I expect nothing in return. That's agape love. Goes on to say that love rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. That's self-explanatory. You know what the opposite of that is, friends? You read the first chapter of the book of Romans, and Paul says, there are men working unseemly things with men and women, with women away from the natural use of the body in sexual depravity. And not only do they do these things, but they rejoice in those that are doing it. And we're living in a day of watching that happening right on our television screens and right in our newspapers. They rejoice in the fact of other people engaging in iniquity. And yet, agape love is the exact opposite. It rejoices in what is true. It rejoices in what is right. And it avoids it, it turns away from iniquity. It has no rejoicing in iniquity whatsoever. It's interesting to watch some people who come through the clinic, and they will tell me, "Oh, we had the greatest night on New Year's Eve, man. I don't even remember nothing till the 3rd of January." Oh, well, you're just an idiot. That's all you are. And they wonder why I don't find that funny, and they wonder why I don't rejoice in that, because I don't rejoice in iniquity. Iniquity is destructive. It hurts people. It destroys their life. It leads them down a path that only leads to tears and to loss and to destruction. And you know, they come and tell me, "Oh, I can't remember a thing for 2 days." Well, you need to grow up real quick. It says that it bears all things, it believes all things, and it hopes all things, and it endures all things. You see, the Elise brought this wonderful message to us a couple, 3 weeks ago. Patiently add to your faith, patient endurance. And that's the next level up of patient endurance, is that it bears all things. Do you know, if a love is pure, it can bear being hurt. It can bear being hurt. It can bear being attacked. It can take a body blow because love of that purity bears all things. And then there's a wonderful close to this. As if that's not enough, Paul says, "And love, agape love, never fails." Wow. I look in the mirror, I can't say that. I look in the mirror and I know I've failed. But this love doesn't fail. If I'm, as your pastor, if I'm to reach this level of loving you in this way, it means my love for you must never fail. No matter what you do, I need to absorb that and respond with a purity of love that embraces you and says, "I love you." It's a very high standard. I wish I could say that I'd reached. But let me tell you something. There's something else about this that you need to get. If I gave you a little questionnaire, it'll tick the box. If you tick the box, and it said, "Your pastor should love me, my pastor should love me with agape love." You tick the box. You should tick the box. Yes, it's true. My elders should love me. Agape love. And you should tick the box. My deacons should love me with this agape love. And you should tick that box. It's all right so far, isn't it? But you should love Wendy with a cup of love. And you have to tick the box. And you have to tick the box because Peter didn't write to pastors. He didn't write to elders. He didn't write to deacons. He wrote to believers. Every believer. Every believer. And he said the standard, God's standard, is to add to your faith agape love. Pure love. And this is what it looks like all of those things. And I've spent the week meditating on those things. Boy, that's a high standard. But that's God's standard. Now, friends, I want to just take you to the end of the Gospel of John. Because it's not insignificant. It is not insignificant that Peter wrote this passage. In fact, it's extremely significant that Peter wrote this passage. Paul could have written it. John could have written it. Timothy probably could have written it. Mark, any of those guys. But Peter. Peter could have written it. And the background of this scripture in John 21 is coming towards the end of the ministry. Jesus starts to prepare the apostles for his departure. No, I like the idea. And Peter jumps up and he says, Lord, I don't know what those blokes are going to do, but I'll tell you what, I will die for you. And Jesus' response was, get thee behind me, Satan, for you savour not the things that are of God, but the things that are of the flesh. What a slap down. He still didn't get it. They go to the Garden of Gethsemane, and the soldiers came, and Peter's still thinking in that same way. So he rips out his sword, slashes at this bloke named Malchus, and slices his ear off. Fell in the dust. Best part about it is, Jesus picked it up and slapped it back on the side of his head and he was healed. Even at that point, the love of Christ was so giving. He says, Peter, put away your sword. You don't know what manner of spirit you're of. Don't you know that I could presently call 10,000 legions of angels, 10,000 times 10,000 angels, and they would be here and deliver me? But that's not God's plan. Put your sword away. Peter puts his sword away. He follows the soldiers. And he goes and sits by the devil's fire in the high priest's court there, warming his hands. And before the cock crew that morning, three times, he denied Christ. He denied knowing him. And he denied with bitter cursing and swearing the third time. And then the cock crow, and Jesus looked at him. What do you reckon was in that look? I've tried to picture this in my mind. I try to put myself in Peter's position. Now, having just done that, and having been told I was going to do it, and then I did it, and as they led Jesus out, he looked at Peter. Just a look. And I'll tell you what was in that look. Agape. Love. Because he knows what is in the heart of man. And it's desperately wicked. Jesus died. He's buried. And the fisherman said, hang this, we're going fishing. Fishing's a lot easier than this theology stuff. And off they went, and they went fishing, and they fished all night, and they got nothing. And they were professional fishermen. They knew what they were doing, but they got nothing. They come to shore, and there he is again, Peter. I don't know what he's doing stark naked on the boat. I don't know what that was about, but that's what he was. And they come to shore, and they look up, and they see a bloke cooking fish on the beach. Peter says, it's the Lord. Didn't wait to get his jocks on, he just jumped in the water. Marches up the beach in his birthday suit. Jesus cooked him breakfast. Now you reckon our men's breakfast is all right. How would you like to have Jesus cook your breakfast? apparently cook fish, so I'm not sure that I'd really be really all that happy with that, but at any rate, there you are. I guess you would if you're hungry enough. And then he has a conversation with Peter. He says, "Hey, Peter," after breakfast, this is, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, lovest thou me more than these?" Because that's what Peter had said, wasn't it? He said that. "Lovest thou these more than me? Lovest thou me more than these?" And he used the word agape. Now Peter's a different man. Peter is just freshly off the bitterest failure of his life. And he says, "Lord, you know that I have a brotherly affection, kindness towards you." He couldn't bring himself to say the word agape. Spiritual growth. And you know what he said then? Jesus said, "Feed my lambs. Stop this fishing nonsense and feed my lambs." The second time he said, "Agape, lovest thou me, agape?" The second time Peter said, "Lord, you know that I love you." And he used the word phileo. Again, brotherly kindness. Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." And the third time, Jesus said to him, "Peter, do you love me?" But he used the word phileo. "Do you have a brotherly, kindly affection towards me?" He put it down at a level that Peter could actually felt he could achieve. And Peter said, Peter then became so agitated because he could see what had happened. And he said, "Yeah, Lord." He said, "Feed my sheep." And now we move up in Peter's life to the end of his life. He's writing the book of 2 Peter. And he says, "Add to your faith agape." He's moved on. He's gone from the failure to experiencing the love of Jesus day by day by day by day. And it's come to be who he is. And it now allows him to write Holy Scripture and say, "Lorraine, add to your faith agape love." Whether he can say that without any hypocrisy whatsoever. You see the growth in Peter to the end of his life. Amen. So where does it sit with you? I'll tell you how you can determine where it sits with you. Whether or not you know and have any possession of agape love you won't actually see it in your actions or even your words. Where you will see it, and where you will see it in a way that it can't be hidden, is in your reactions. It's not how you act under deliberate, thoughtful intention. It's how you react in that moment in time when you get up and you do something you should never have done. You get up and you walk off angry. Angry is not part of the parcel. You get up and you walk off and you're offended. Being offended is not part of the parcel, because a love, the agape love, is so pure, it doesn't react like that. it reacts in long-suffering, patience and kindness. I want to challenge you. I want to absolutely challenge you. Go to that passage in 1 Corinthians 13 and read it over and over again and ask the Holy Spirit to tell you, do I exhibit this or do I not? Be prepared to be honest. God bless you, folks.